You are now going to listen to KAZ iBook Review with Hopeton Hick.
Heaven, My Home is Attica Locke's second novel in her Highway 59 series set in East Texas. This time, her novel is set on the border of Texas and Louisiana, where the young son of an imprisoned member of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas has disappeared while on Caddo Lake, a sprawling lake that crosses the Louisiana border. Black Texas Ranger Darren Matthews, the protagonist of the Highway 59 series, is sent to the area to assist the local sheriff with the search for the boy. His boss also sent him to gain information to help with the task force dedicated to bringing down the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. With Heaven My Home, Locke continues her exploration of race in America through the prism of her crime fiction novels. She displays it through her protagonist's reception by the local townspeople in Jefferson, Texas. She also explores it through the debate his uncles that raised him engaged in time and time again. And I quote, whether forgiveness made black folks saints or stooges. She also includes as an integral part of her story a historic black community in the area, Hopetown, that was founded by blacks after the Civil War and is home also to Caddo Indians. Attica Locke is the award-winning author of five novels and a screenwriter. Her novel, Bluebird, Bluebird, was the winner of the Mystery Writers of America 2018 Edgar Award for Best Novel. She was also a writer and producer on the Emmy Award-winning Netflix series about the Central Park Five, When They See Us. Attica Locke, welcome back to KAZI Book Review.
Oh, as always, thank you for having me.
Attica, I have to admit that there were times, especially in the second half of the novel, that I was using words I can't use on the air, expressing my anger with certain characters in the novel. Sometimes it was just the reveals that came about had me cursing in joy. And I want to talk about the plotting of this, because the way that as the book moved on, the way that the plot tied all the way back to the beginning of the book, and as you learn these things, you're thinking, that's right, I remember that part of the book there, and of course I'm not going to reveal too much of it. So can you talk about how you were able to take these plot elements and tie them not just to actions, but history, the way characters are acting. So this just subtle weave of different ways of tying the plot reveals to other parts of the novel.
Well, the old adage that writing is rewriting is apt here, because, you know, I'm a lot of times finding it as I write. I mean, for these Highway 59 novels, I've done outlines because I want them to be tight. I kind of set that as my, I think when I sold the series to the publisher, I said I want it to be tightly coiled rural noir. So I want them to be very tight. So I've outlined them, but as I'm writing, I'm still discovering certain things. And so a lot of times I will go back and weave stuff in to make sure that I've dropped these kind of Easter eggs along the way. But in terms of finding the story itself, my research process, I find the story in the research. Like, when I started looking into Caddo Lake, when I started looking into Jefferson, like, it's like I let the research reveal a story to me. And I start, you know, finding out the history of Jefferson and the steamboat travel and how Jefferson was supposed to be bigger than Dallas, that it was at some point. And then, you know, through happenstance, Jefferson got passed by, and that ended up kind of forming the culture there of this town. And so that gives me something. And then the antebellum stuff gives me something. The Caddo Indians gives me something. And then somehow I just kind of, I don't know, my brain just kind of starts to put it all together.
And let's jump into the setting, because this is the second novel featuring Darren. And he's sent to Marion County, to Hopetown, to investigate the disappearance of the son of a jailed captain of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. And of course, Darren is working on the task force trying to take down the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. Now, what's different about the second novel in your 59 series is that this one is set on the border of Louisiana. And yeah. So there's a strong element of Louisiana in it.
Yeah.
And part of this frustration with Darren is at one point in the novel, he says, I want to get back to my East Texas. So talk a little bit about your decision to move the setting closer to Louisiana.
Well, this series is so much about location, When I conceived of this series, there were certain towns that popped in my psyche immediately, where I was like, I kind of know I'm going to write about that place. And Caddo Lake was like the number two thing that I was like, I got to write about. It's too interesting. A lake that crosses a state line, that has all these islands in it, that looks like something that's like nowhere else in the world. I just knew I wanted to write about Jefferson and Caddo Lake. So it really kind of came from that place. And I was nervous about it because of exactly what you say. I'm not, even though my dad was raised in Marshall, which is not that far from Jefferson at all, it's not my East Texas, and it's not where my people really come from, which is further south. And I was very nervous about, well, what if I'm just not going to feel the same way writing it, because I don't know this place, and, you know, what if this and what if that? But I kind of then just leaned into that fact and leaned into the fact that whenever Darren comes into these towns, he's a fish out of water. He's an interloper. Well, then you had a double kind of interloper. You had a, yes, he's coming into this little town, but he's also not of this part of East Texas. It has an element to its culture that is not like the East Texas further south. And then I also have to add, Hopetown. So the town is called Hopetown, and it's, you know, my people come from a freedmen's community called Nigton, which used to be Niggertown, and then used to be, you know, like Nigtown, then Nigton. And I was going to name this town Hopetown, and I was like, I can't do that because Hopetown is...
Wait. Now, this interview is over. I missed my opportunity to actually be in your novel.
I was going to call it Hopetown, but then I was like, that's going to be weird because I know him.
Wow. And Darren, you describe your novel as rural noir, and I was on a panel recently at Book People here, and the discussion between the difference between a hard-boiled crime novel and a noir novel, and I was also thinking about an article that Meg Abbott, another crime fiction author, wrote about the difference between hard-boiled and noir. And the more you explore the character of Darren, the Black Texas Ranger protagonist, the more noir it feels. Because there's a point in the novel where he's in his car, the radio's turned up, the windows are rolled down, and actually, I shouldn't even say car, forgive me, Texans, he's in his truck. And he says, or you write that he has a fear of falling off the cliff of his own morality.
Yeah.
He is, this character is so real in terms of some of the questionable decisions he makes, how you play with his lack of sympathy for the young boy that disappeared, his feelings toward the Aryan Brotherhood representatives and the white people who are, you know, very racist in this town. It's almost like he's in a town that goes back to the 40s or 50s with their view of African Americans, and he has mostly no sympathy for who they are because of the way they treat Black people.
Yes, and yet his job is to protect everybody. That's what the badge means, and I think there's another part of the book where he talks about the fact that his uncle, who has all of these ideas about what it means that his nephew is a ranger, he doesn't like it, and thinks he's on the wrong side of the law as a Black man. And that he says, well, my uncle can have those ideas in academia. He's a professor, but I'm out here living the question. Like, for whatever you want to make of it, I'm living the contradiction. I'm trying to figure it out. And in that way, he's a kind of, I kind of don't want to use the word soldier, but he's somebody just trying to navigate what the badge means. Can you protect everybody, if everybody doesn't even want your protection, if everybody doesn't even see you as a full citizen, how do you navigate this?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI Austin, 88.7 FM. I'm Hopetown Hay. My guest is Attica Locke. We're talking about the second book in her 59 series novel set in East Texas, Heaven, My Home. One of the recurring themes in this book that sort of goes throughout the book is whether or not Black folks should forgive white folks. And
yes,
even within his own household, his uncles that raised him, Clayton and William, they don't agree.
No, they do not. And I think this is an eternal kind of question that a lot of wounded and marginalized groups have had to ask themselves. You know, I think a lot about the Diary of Anne Frank. I remember reading it as a child, and that line of, in spite of everything, I still believe people are good at heart. And in the play version of it, her father says, she puts me to shame. And I feel like I live that those poles. Like there is a part of me that naturally, my human instinct, my level of optimism, my sense of fellowship with other people is forgiveness. That is my instinct. And yet, I feel like there was a part of me on the other side of the election of Barack Obama that felt a heart opening and a willingness to maybe like forgive and kind of start anew. I never thought we were going to be seeing a post-racial society. I didn't want a post-racial society, but I did believe that. Put it this way, I'm 45 years old. My whole existence is on the other side of the civil rights movement. So what I have seen over the course of my lifetime was the slow and difficult and violent fulfillment of Dr. King's dream, which was that on this arc of the moral universe, we were bending towards justice. It was difficult. We lost people along the way. There were setbacks. But over the course of my life, it looked like we were on a trajectory up towards equity, parity, and equality. And it felt like it culminated for me in the election of Barack Obama. And then along came Trump, and I was like, whoa, wait a second. I let my guard down because I thought, oh, we could start anew. But I didn't realize, I don't know what to do with all of these people, all of my fellow citizens who voted for Trump, because I have a feeling of betrayal about it. And I also know that one day Trump will be gone, and we all still have to live together. But knowing that so many of the Americans voted for him means I don't feel quite safe in my country, because you're harboring these feelings that came out when you went into that poll, when you went into the voting booth.
I tell you, with the character Darren, the racism he encounters in the town, he's working with a sheriff that's really trying to hold him on a short leash, who has a Make America Great hat again in his office. When he goes to visit, presumably, the richest woman in town, because it's her grandson that has disappeared, it's almost like every question he asks, she doesn't look at him. She's looking at the sheriff.
Yes.
And for her, black folks are invisible. And it reminds me, of course, of the novel by Rolf Ellison, Invisible. And he feels the invisibility in this novel. So talk a bit about, or when you write those kind of scenes, because race is front and center. You do not hide the racial battles that black folks face in everyday life. It is there front and center in the novels. Does that touch you emotionally when you were writing these scenes?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think every book I've ever written, there's a moment where I kind of, in the writing, have tears and kind of, you know, have a cathartic kind of moment, because a part of what this writing is you're kind of working out stuff in your psyche. But yes, I feel emotion when I am writing these scenes and when I'm talking about race from this point of view. And in some ways, this, it's probably not fair to say the latest book you wrote always feels freshest, so it's probably not accurate really to say it's the most emotional thing I've written. But my emotions around Trump and what has happened to this country are high. And so, and you'll, about that sheriff with the MAGA hat, in the novel, when he first meets Darren, he treats him with parity. And it's important to note that that's what it feels like for black folks, that you can meet somebody, they're decent to you, they shake their hand, and then you find out what's really in their heart is ultimately they can be fine with you individually, but they still want to hold up white supremacy. And that contradiction, living in that is so stressful. It's just so stressful to not know which white folks sometimes that you can really trust, which face of theirs to really believe. So, yes, all of this stuff is incredibly emotional to me. And even it took me after I wrote the book to realize even where that little boy who goes missing, where it came from for me. There was, at my daughter's school, she goes to a very progressive school here in Southern California, a white child called a black kid the N-word. And I was not prepared for this. I was stunned. I could not believe we were in 2016 and and we were in Southern California in all its liberalism. And what happened after this incident is that a family discussion broke out between me, my husband, and my daughter at the dinner table. I would say we've discussed it 20 times about forgiveness, because my daughter was able to forgive him and say, you know what, Mommy, I kind of feel sorry for him. I don't know what's going on with him, but I'm willing to see kind of past that and forgive him. I, as an older woman, was not. And then I had these feelings of like, who are you, Attica, that you can't forgive a child? A child, Attica? And yet, I really struggled with this. And I didn't realize as I was writing the book that I was working that out, but I think that's where this 9-year-old white kid who you find out has been influenced by the white supremacists and terrorists in his life. And is he going to be indoctrinated into this and become one of them, or can he be saved? So this trying to find him is almost a metaphor for can this child be saved? Like, not just found, but can his soul be saved?
Are you playing with this? Is his father, Bill King, the imprisoned former captain of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas, is he seeking a redemption arc? Is he on a redemption arc? Is it real or is it not? Or is that what you want us as the readers to try to figure out?
I want you to ask the question because I don't know. I don't know. Again, the optimist in me, because that is just my soul setting is optimism. The optimism in me says maybe that is real. I mean, I don't want to give away plot, but he's willing to do certain things to pay for his crimes in the way that the state has not asked him to pay for his crimes. So I want to say in my soul, maybe that's real. But I understand Darren saying, I don't know that it's real. I might use it for my own purposes, but I don't know that his redemption is real.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Attica Locke. We're talking about her second book in the 59 series, Heaven My Heaven, and she will be appearing at the Texas Book Festival on Saturday, October the 26th, I believe at 2 p.m., on a panel with Steph Cha, both writers living in Los Angeles, California. But you are from Houston, Texas. Now, I was thinking of this song by War. I don't know if you're very familiar with War, but they have a song called City, Country, City.
I don't know this song.
And it's on their album called The World is a Ghetto. And I thought about that song when I thought about the novel and your history, because I thought the song that would write your history would be Country, City, Country. Because your family's from the country, rural Texas, but
yes,
you grew up 100% in Houston. You went to college in Chicago, and
yeah,
then you moved to Los Angeles, California, yet you always come back to home, and home for you is East Texas, and you have this incredible love that is just so obvious with your lush and vivid descriptions of what it's like to sit on the porch and look out at the land. Matter of fact, there's a point in the novel where you're throwing up, hey, East Texas looks just as good as Florence, Italy.
Yes, I do love it so. I mean, and you're right, I never really lived there, but I certainly spent so much time in rural East Texas as a child. Like, a lot of my formative memories are of visiting relatives who still lived in these small towns along Highway 59. And so I guess it's just in that way deep in my soul. But the older I get, the more, you know, all of us kind of reflect on our lives and our families as we get older, I'm able to see what some of the values of rural Black Texans that have informed my life and enriched my life and made my life possible. So a lot of this is paying homage to my ancestors, paying homage to a particular strain of Texas culture that doesn't always get a light shown on it. But I come from rural people. I mean, agrarian life built my whole family. It put people through college. It gave people PhDs. I mean, everything came out of dirt. I mean, it's just true that from farming, people were able to make this incredible life.
Let me talk a bit about Lisa and Greg and how much I don't like them at the moment. Now, for our listeners, Lisa is the wife of Darren. Greg is his best friend. They all went to high school together. Darren is on there. He's having trouble with his marriage. Greg is an FBI agent. who's decided to get involved in the investigation, but from a different angle. And to some degree, what I love about the complexity of the character is when you have your friends and your family trying to pull you in a direction you really don't want to go.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, their friendship to me is so interesting. It says the person who wrote it, but I find that to be so accurate. I mean, I certainly have very close white folks in my life, and there's such a love and friendship between them. And Greg and what he's trying to do about this missing child and turn it into a federal case and all this kind of stuff, he has good intentions, but I don't know another way to put it, except that his whiteness allows him to approach it in a way that Darren never could. And those two trying to navigate is interesting to me. And about the Lisa Greg thing, I will just let the readers take that journey.
Hey, but what about, is it Randy? Did I get that?
Yeah, Randy, yeah.
Yeah, and so we have a, all of this, and this is continuing from the first novel, so you have to go back. You don't have to, but it's really good to go back and read Bluebird, because there's this continuation of these storylines. And Darren, you know, he's got the challenge of a potential being in trouble with a DA in a county with the death that happened in the previous novel. His relationship with his wife is questionable. She wants him to stay in the office. He loves to travel. And he's still torn inside between the philosophical differences between his two uncles that raised him, much less talking about the hot mess of the uncles over the same woman. He's a hot mess.
He is. And God bless him. And we're all a little bit of a hot mess. And we're all just trying to figure it out.
Wow. Yeah, that is. But that's what makes the character interesting, because I'll read novels where the protagonist is strong. He has a few problems here or there. I mean, just a little, but he's very confident and very strong, knows where he's doing, what he's doing. Darren is a character that questions himself.
Yes.
And questions his decisions. So really, as I was reading a little bit of history of horrible novels, which is you want to write these novels where those characters are realistic, he's as real can be, real people.
Well, that is high praise, because that is what I hope, that he really comes off the page and that you feel compassion for his struggle.
I got to ask you a question, though. So
he
has all these challenges, right? Is he getting checkups regularly? Is he checking his high blood pressure? Is his heart okay?
He probably should. He probably should.
He's got to have high blood pressure with all this stuff going on, internal and external.
He and all that drinking.
Yeah. Hey, Jim Beam.
Yeah, all that drinking, yeah.
Yeah, what is this about Jim Beam? Is that sort of the whiskey of choice in East Texas or of his family?
No, not really. It's the one that kind of came out for me, and I just went with it. And I think in the book, at different places, he'll drink something different, but it just kind of, I don't know, it just sounded good. It just was the right thing. My dad is a whiskey drinker, and he drinks something you can hardly find anywhere but in Texas, which is Ezra Brooks whiskey. But I thought if I put that in the book, people are going to be like, what the hell is that?
Right. And you love blues. There is no doubt. But you grew up in the hip-hop/R&B era, but you love blues. And it permeates the novel.
You know what? I've always been a person who listens to older music my whole life, even as a young child. I don't know why. I just always have loved older music. And so in a lot of ways, certainly I was at parties and I would have a love of hip hop and be in it, but it wasn't really what I was listening to at home. That I was more listening to older R&B from the 60s and 70s, or I was listening to blues, or even listening to classic rock during a time where I wasn't alive. I just have kind of always been that way. But again, as I get older, the way that blues feels so linked to my culture, the specific rural Texas culture, it just is a salve for me. that it is the thing that I reach for when I am struggling. That the music both, and in fact, that's where the title comes from. The title is from a Jesse May Hemphill version of I Shall Not Be Moved. It's an old folk song and like Negro spiritual. And a lot of people record it and they always have a different versions. Her version has a line about I'll make heaven my home. And throughout the book, there's a theme about what is home for people and how do black folks claim home. And I make a point that in blues songs, there's never a sense that I'm happy where I'm actually standing and I belong here. There's always a sense of movement or reaching for something somewhere else. And a lot of the times, black music, spirituals, gospel, blues will look skyward because there's a sense of the land that we're standing on does not respect us, does not promise anything to us. We don't know that we really can claim it because we were brought here, but I can promise you I'm going to answer to something higher. And I, a lot of times in my life, will look to that. There's a great song by Eric Bibb, don't let nobody drag you down. And there's a line, remember, you're walking up to heaven. And I play this song all the time when I'm upset, all the time when I feel like I'm wrestling with something and people are I don't understand their point of view. I try to remind myself I'm answering to something higher.
Well, will you be disappointed when I say that I've looked up I Can't Quit You Baby by Little Milton, and when I looked it up in YouTube and I just put in I Can't Quit You Baby, that the first video that popped up was Led Zeppelin?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that is a little weird, but okay.
I had to put in Little Milton just to find the video. The first thing that popped up, talk about cultural roots of rock and roll.
yeah. Yeah, a lot of people covered. In fact, the Rolling Stones did a blues album about 2 years ago, and that's a cover that's in the album. It's very good, but yeah, I like Little Milton's version.
Well, can I persuade you to come back on in the future to do a more in-depth interview? Because there is a whole lot of stuff I couldn't even get to for this short 26, 27-minute interview.
Yes, I will.
Attica Locke, author of Heaven My Heaven. Her website is atticalocke.com. Thanks for being a guest on KAZI Book Review.
Thank you for having me.